cast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. So pour yourself a cup of tea or a gin and tonic.
But not a toxin.
And join us on a chronological journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every single one of them a game changer.
So, Carolyn, what book are we talking about today?
For our first podcast.
First podcast.
I would have sung that, but I'm tone deaf. So
many kinds of deafness.
Yes, this one is, even when someone's singing happy birthday, I'm like just mouthing the words. And it's really salvational. It's very helpful for everyone present. So, podcast. we are talking about The Murders in the Rue Morgue, which is a story written in 1841 by Edgar Allan Poe. Look at this very lovely orange and black cover here.
We brought some copies here of the ones we read out of. These two big ones are old. I don't even know if you can get this one or this one.
Well, this one you can get if you steal it from a library.
You didn't hear that here.
This one is used, as it is stamped on the back.
Yeah, which is my preference, but this one is the most affordable on Amazon.
Yes.
I liked it because it had a lot of different ones in it. Unfortunately, it only had one Poe. It had Murders in the Rue Morgue, so this was the copy I read that out of. But for next month, when we do The Purloined Letter, I'll be borrowing one of Carolyn's copies.
The one taken from a library.
Yes, the very book.
You also still have not heard that here.
I want to see the notes, too. We went through and we read the book, and we made a lot of notes
questions. We do. And so let's just preface that by, like, I mean, Sarah, you've been doing this book club for 9 years called Porn.
Yes, the Porn Reading Program.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's it called?
It's called the Porn Reading Program with like two M's and an E, traditionally.
Oh, sure. So you read stories published in Playboy magazine
Yes. We started out, I found this list of like the 50, I believe it was 50 most important books written by women throughout history, and it started in 10th century Japan with the Tale of Genji, and that was, I mean, not specifically the Tale of Genji, but the whole concept was kind of right up my alley. I liked going chronological. I thought it would add an aspect of seeing, like, the very development of the novel, because the very first novel was that Tale of Genji. That's typically
debatable.
I was going to say, yeah, you probably know this. On the list, it was considered the first novel, and it was so unnovel-like. It was this, like, story arc, not invented yet, all of these things. So you could kind of see structures of the novel emerge as we were reading through. Not every story was super interesting, but a lot of them were, and a lot of them were kind of just interesting for kind of what they brought to the genre.
Yeah.
So I guess that kind of transfers a little bit to the plan we made for this.
Well, what kind of? So this wasn't a typical book club, I would say. As somebody who has been a member of a book club, and I used to run a book club, I used to have a paid role as a book club.
Really?
Yes, I used to lead a paid book club.
See, now we're both learning things about each other.
Yeah, so the members would pay me to, it's crazy, I know.
Get that job. Here I am just like slaving away for free.
I don't know. I wanted to read and make money, Sarah.
I don't know. I'm just a sucker that wants to read.
Yeah. But the people obsessed with reading novels.
Yes.
Porn.
People obsessed with reading novels.
Because get your mind out of the gutter. It wasn't just analysis of the book, though that's important, right? We want to read the book. We want to think about the book. We want to talk about the book. But the book, whatever the book is, or the story is, it makes us think about things in our own lives. It allows us to be not just analytical about the book and do a close reading, but it allows us to have some introspective moments where we see how ideas, themes, characters, plot developments relate to our own lives.
Yeah, that's what I like about reading fiction, actually, is whenever I would read books, I would have all of these thoughts. And I was like, I want to tell someone my thoughts. And, you know, things feel, they feel a little more real when you're talking to someone about them. And I would say it helps clarify your own thoughts to try and explicitly get them out of your brain into a sentence. But no one was ever reading the thing I was reading. So, and it was kind of like, that was my last year of grad school. I was like, you know what I want to do? I'm going to start this book club. And so, that's what I did. And so, and also if the book was fine, but actually kind of the relatableness of the content was more interesting. So I sort of exclusively just talked about questions inspired by the book. So you didn't have to read the book at all to go, but I don't think we're going to be that far gone on this podcast.
No, we want to read the books. We want you to read the books. I mean, these are amazing. Let's just call it out, right? These are amazing stories. These are amazing novels.
I'm very excited. I haven't read most of them.
And I've read some of them and haven't read others. And in the ones I've read, in some cases, I haven't read in like 20 years. So I'm super excited to have this chance to read some new books and to like revisit some books that I loved in the past. We're starting with Edgar Allan Poe because it just makes logical sense. A lot of people say that Edgar Allan Poe's short stories featuring Auguste Dupin are the first mystery stories, the first one with a detective lead, and that it sets the scene for a bunch of tropes that are used later with Sam Spade and Hercule Poirot and Sherlock Holmes, all these detectives, right? So it's this outsider, this guy sort of, you know, a little bit removed from the norm. Super smart. He has this one friend who, for some reason, loves to record every single thing he says and then narrate stories. And there's a lot of tropes that are developed in Poe. And what we want to do, I think, and maybe just talk for a second about, you know, people obsessed with reading novels, that group. The chronology is important. Understanding a foundation of something is important.
Yeah. So, and I think Carolyn was super instrumental when we were talking through what we wanted this to be. And we landed on sort of the genre of mystery. It seemed really fun. It was a genre I'm not super familiar with. You know, we talked about, I didn't even know the Edgar Award was a thing, but I'm excused. I went to grad school for material science and engineering. So this is just, my love is reading novels. But, Carolyn, who actually knows what she's doing here, helped craft the list of what are those foundational novels along the evolution of, like, the mystery genre. So this whole first segment, this first year, will be, a year sounds like a lot, but we're just going at the pace, really, of reading. So it's like once a month.
Right.
We're reading
a book each month, which join us in our book club, right? So, you know, a book a month is manageable. If it's a super big book, as sometimes they are, Bleak House is our third month. It's also going to be our fourth month. It's that large and it's that important. So we want to devote the time it takes to read these books and really like build this basis of what the canon or the mystery genre, sort of the foundation of the mystery genre, and like build off of that, starting with Poe in 1841 with The Murders in the Rue Morgue. We're going to move on to The Purloined Letter. We're going to move on to Bleak House. What we're going to do in this first year together, we hope, is together. Join and again, us. I would have sung that, but by now we know. Now I can't sing that. Victorian and Edwardian period. So we're going to go right up, I think, to 1910, and that's going to give us a super clean start for the modern period in our second year, and we'll get to Agatha Christie and a lot of the greats at that point. But, I mean, the greats were born here. This year is like where it all started and where the authors are experimenting with a form that was not widely understood or embraced. There's a lot of courage here in the writing, and there's a lot of experimentation, some of which is successful. And, you know, we might decide, like Sarah and I might decide, you might decide, like, okay, this is really hard to read, or I don't feel like this really worked. The cool thing is that they tried it, and in the trying, they established something that later other authors were able to take and sort of spin on its head and make it work.
Right. And I love that, you know, as someone in science and engineering, like the whole experimental aspect, I'm always keen. You know, we always say like, oh, there's no bad data as long as it's like correct data, you know, as long as it's real, mm-hmm. It's interesting and you can learn from it. And,
yeah.
You know, if you're like me and you're a little bit cloudy when Carolyn says the Edwardian period and you're like, what exactly defines?
Yeah.
I know these words.
So but we're talking about the years in which Queen Victoria and King Edward lived, right? So we're talking about like in 19th century England, which is
Edwardian synonymous with Victorian?
No, he was after Victoria.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're talking about periods that have sort of definitive demarcation points in literature. So Victorian novels are often, but not always, large. They're triple-decker novels. They have three parts. Bleak House is not a quick, you know, I got 4 hours free on the train, maybe I'll read Bleak House. Like, that's not how that book works. A lot of mystery novels today, that's perfect for the train. It's perfect for the plane. It's perfect for, you know, I've got the beach vacation, I'm going to go sit under the umbrella, I'm going to read this book. But a book like Bleak House is, I mean, man, it is some work, but I got to tell you, it's worth it. It's amazing.
It's been great so far. I haven't read it before. I'm about halfway through now. I love it. I think about it when I'm not with it. But that's what I love about novels.
So Edwardian novels are, in many cases, going to borrow from Victorian. They're going to often times use that three-part structure, not always, but they're going to start slimming down, and they're going to play with those three parts in ways that the Victorians didn't. And then come the modernist era, 1910, 1914, whatever year you want to start that period in, it fluctuates. They're going to do away in large part with that structure. So they're going to really make the story, the novel, a different thing altogether. So the Edwardians borrow, but sort of make it their own. And that's awesome. The period we're following this year, is we're going to see the conventions of the novels and stories of that period. We're going to watch the foundations evolve. You know, there's a quote, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle said, he of course wrote all the Sherlock Holmes stories that are so famous. He said, where was the detective story until Poe breathed life into it?
All right. So I was going to say it's debatable whether or not Poe's the originator, but Sir Arthur Conan Doyle agrees with that. But that kind of leads to also, like, we hope any listeners that might be listening at any point in time.
All four of you.
Participate with us. And, you know, if you disagree, you're like, look at the list for the year and you're like, well, where's this?
Yeah.
Important. You know, we want to hear that. And as you're reading the book, hopefully you can kind of get the flavor of the types of questions and throw some of your own out there, or feelings or thoughts that you're having. I was telling Carolyn, I'm reading you know, like 200 pages into Bleak House, and I probably have like notes on 175 pages of it because I have an addiction to writing while I read. And also, there's just that many kind of thoughts and things pinging around in there as I read it. But I don't know. Should we dive into this one?
And let's do. And so many people have called this the first mystery story. But of course, there are Arabic, Chinese, German, and French forebears to this story. So we're not, Sarah and I are not posing as like the foremost experts in the canon and in like the history of the mystery and thriller genre. We're just not. But we think that this story, The Murders in the Rue Morgue, is important enough that we start right here. So let's do dive in.
Yeah. Should we start with the questions?
Okay.
I'll read the first question.
Yeah.
So the first pages of the story introduce the kind of analysis that makes detection possible. Did this intro draw you in, frustrate you, or something else entirely? What were you thinking about that question?
It simultaneously frustrated me and made me feel smarter for reading it.
I think that's fair. You know, I was reading it. Carolyn kind of posted, like, it's only 30 pages. And I was like, that is a dense 30 pages.
It's a one-hour read, right? So you can time yourself, and it'll be, like, between 55 and 65 minutes.
I probably spend longer, I got to be honest, because I had to reread a bunch of it.
So rereading's optional, encouraged, but just to get through it, right? Moby Dick, I'm just going to digress for a second.
Don't give it away. I still haven't read it yet.
She hasn't. So, The Whale Wins. Moby Dick, is this really interesting book where, the author, Melville, inserts all of these chapters that are cetology chapters about whales. Many people argue you can skip these chapters if you want.
I need you to define the word cetology.
Whales.
Just whales?
Study of whales.
Whale chapters about whales.
Whale chapters. So it's really about the physiology of the whale and the et cetera. It's about the whale.
Well, that's interesting. I still haven't read it.
So, I'm sure I've raised everybody's interest in reading this book now.
I own it.
It's an amazing, amazing book, but it's considered a legitimate way to read the book is to skip the cetology chapters. Well, there was a part of me, and I'm not going to get into that debate. Like, I read the cetology chapters. I'm not science-y. I think, is that the word? Science-y? Like, Sarah?
Yes, that's the technical term.
But I read the cetology chapters in Melville and Moby Dick. And there were times where I was reading the beginning of The Murders in the Rue Morgue and I thought, boy, I could just skip over all this and get right to the story.
Yeah, I like what you said. I like the perspective that it made you smarter. Like, I was reading it and I was rereading it. And it wasn't that it was boring. It was very interesting, but it's not the way language is used currently.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times you read a modern book and your brain can just kind of slip in there and flow along. And, it doesn't have that cadence. Maybe I wondered if it did at the time, but I think probably it was still, a difficult book, even for the time, probably. That you have to really concentrate and think about, like, what is he saying? What is he saying? So I found myself just kind of like, where is he going with this? And I found this both in this book and in Bleak House, like, am I reading the right book? is this a mystery book? Is there a murder here? Because it just doesn't start out that way.
Philosophical treatise? What is this?
Right. He just kind of talks about analysis and then talks about games and ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. But as I was reading it, you know, just putting aside like the where is this going thought, I really, and this probably leads a little bit into question two about the games. Like, I really just found myself thinking like, wow, he's parsing this apart. You know, he's speaking about intelligences mm-hmm. in a way that we don't currently speak about intelligences.
Right.
Like, being in science, so my bachelor's is in physics, and even just with a bachelor's in physics, people would be like, oh, you must be really smart. And then they'd ask me some question, totally, you know, like, not related to physics. And even if it is related to physics, there's so much that I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Which is like, what's this random answer to this question I have? And I'm like, I don't know that, but sometimes...
But they hear the word physics, and they're right. Like, oh my God, like you have to be... You must be a genius.
Smart or not smart. Mm. And Poe is really kind of, you know, untangling this in a way that we don't really talk about these intelligences the way that he was.
Yeah, different kinds of intelligence. Like, I think you and I talked about this a little bit, and you had said, well... People's, you know, somebody's smart or they're not smart. That's how a lot of people are defined. Oh, that friend of mine. Oh, she's really smart. Oh, he's very smart. He's not very smart. What have you? It's like, it's this sort of like black and white demarcation, whereas Holmes is complicating it.
Yeah. Oh.
I'm sorry.
No, that's cool.
Remember when we said we wouldn't need to edit anything?
We're not. It's in there.
Oh, man.
I can't always be looking like the one that doesn't know what she's talking about.
So I have to look like that? I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, so Poe, yeah, he's sort of demarcating, right? He's grouping different kinds of intelligence.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of times the only caveat I really hear in the conversation currently is like, oh, well, he's just really book smart, mm-hmm. but he lacks common sense, you mm-hmm. know, as though it's that simple either, but so I really liked it. Maybe we should jump into question two. That's where the games kind of break down. Using different games to break down intelligences.
Yes, and let me just this is probably a good point to mention that our website, which is teatonicandtoxin.com, has these questions on it, so you can actually follow along with the sort of we're walking through a conversation over the in this case, 10 things that matter deeply to us. And we've taken a story and sort of like shrunk it down to 10 main things, all of which have, you know, branches off of the tree and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. And thanks for pointing that out, Caroline. We do really like, would love it to be a conversation, especially, you know, if you will post the questions prior to the podcast.
Yeah.
And so if you have things to say, you know, maybe we'll read them and bring them up.
Oh no, we will read them. We will. Let me. We will attempt to bring them up.
Yeah,
but we will read them.
That was one of the hard and fast rules of the porn reading program that I was like really adamant about, was that everyone speaks, mm-hmm. everyone answers, and if someone was like not figuring it out, we would just sit silently until we asked them to be like, Carolyn, what are your thoughts?
Yes. And Sarah's very good at that. Yes.
Sitting silently, I can do it.
But also just, you know, like, hey, what do you think? So the person sitting silent has an opinion also. And we want to hear that. Like, we want to make this a book club where we're discussing things that matter to the story, but also to ourselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And yourselves.
And yourselves.
And yourselves. So in question two, why do you think the narrator compares chess and whist? And I'll say, I forgot to bring the postcard.
You didn't bring the postcard.
Draught. I'll bring it next time because we're still doing Poe.
Yeah.
And you said it was called pronounced drafts. Drafts. Yeah. It looks like draughts. It's pronounced drafts. And I like put that on the website and Carolyn goes, that's checkers.
Now, let me rephrase. Sarah wrote, why don't we play this game called draughts anymore?
And I said, you're saying it wrong and you're thinking about it wrong.
It's pronounced drafts, and it's another name for drafts is checkers.
Yeah, and then she had this postcard which she mailed me, the medieval game of drafts.
It did, yeah.
From, like, you said you had the postcard for 20 years.
Oh, yeah, a long time. So I got it from London. When on one of my trips to London, and I have, I'm sure this is fascinating. a box full of postcards and things that I have collected from my travels.
And not sent, but saved until needed.
Not sent, but saved until needed. Yeah. And this one, I was like, oh, finally, I have something to do. Because you can't just randomly mail somebody a postcard with this checkers game. Although it allows you, it had little pieces and you could cut the pieces out.
Yes, you could. I'm not cutting it though because we have checkers. We can just get a game of checkers.
Right.
I don't have to deface my postcard.
It's not an expensive game. So it's not as if like, oh, now I don't have to buy checkers because I have this weird postcard. It's, yes.
Which, so that made me, I was like, have you played Whist? Do you know how to play Whist?
I don't know how to play Whist, but I know a couple things about Whist. What do you know about Whist?
Nothing, except that it's like the Victorian game of choice. People would play it in the evenings. People were addicted to it.
Maybe. So some probably portion of the population was, and I think that they played it in pairs. So you would have four people play. You would have a partner. And you would play against two other people who were partners. And my understanding is that you would have to figure out what you wanted to play from your own hand while looking around the table and seeing what other people played and trying to determine what your partner had in his or her hand and what the other two players had in their hands. So, interestingly, right, Poe, because this is not Sherlock Holmes. Let's just be clear. This is Edgar Allan Poe.
He'll be coming, though.
Poe, or the narrator, the unnamed, weird unnamed narrator, differentiates between whist and chess. So what's your thought about this differentiation now that I've just...
Well, now that you've told me, it's certainly, you know, chess is very singular. And I really liked, maybe because I'm not great at chess, but he was kind of putting it down a little bit. Like, chess isn't like that smart of a game. It's not an analytical game. You just have to have really good concentration to be able to see, like, five moves ahead. Which I've always felt... That's true. And so I actually got kind of excited at that part because I'm not good at it. Like, I can think three moves ahead, but then I can't hold the board in my head anymore.
Yeah.
Like, what it's going to look like at that point, and I can't make intelligent moves going forward. So, you know, that's definitely a contrast between this sort of dynamic of trying to play with your partner and, like, beat your other two partners. Have you played Euchre?
I have played Euchre, yeah.
It sounded like Euchre the way you were describing it.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. My family grew up on a game that's not unlike Euchre called 45. It's an Irish game, and the goal is with your partner to get to 45 points in multiple hands. So that same sort of thing where you're reading your partner, and then you're trying to read these other two people. And and you don't have to play partners in 45. You can play individuals, but it's usually played as partners. And my grandparents taught my siblings and me how to play. My grandmother and grandfather usually were partnered, but they would sometimes break apart. And, like, my sister Michelle would be with my grandmother and I'd be with my grandfather. My grandfather was this guy who had this – big personality, and he would, when we were playing, like, give me the biggest verbal or visual signals. He'd be like, oh, this hand, and I would look at him and I'd be like, got it. or he'd be like, oh, Carolyn, Carolyn, oh, and my grandmother would be like, oh, she would get so mad. I think what the narrator in this story is suggesting is even if you don't have the grandmother doing this and the grandfather going, you should be able to read the subtle signs of what people are doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense too. The way Poe sets the story up, he really focuses on how, is it Dupin? Dupin?
Dupin.
Dupin.
Yeah.
Was just, like, able to read him to kind of this, I would say, very unrealistic level, but It was very interesting. Yeah, so the reading people part is interesting, and it made me think while I was reading this, like, there's this game that I love called Set. Have you ever played it?
I have not. I've wanted to since you've mentioned it. I have not played it.
Love it. It's a card game, but it's not with normal cards. It's with set cards, and they have all these different patterns, and you're finding things in common across the patterns, shapes, colors, textures. And then in this game of speed. So it's not just about pattern finding. It's about, like, pattern finding quickly, and you're racing, you know, your opponent. And one thing I love about it, and the only way I can win, it's like it sends you into this, like, zen state of non-thinking.
Yeah.
Which I completely love. Like, I don't have any other game that will do this, and you just, like, blank it out. I only like to play, like, on the floor, sitting down. And I like to play by myself sometimes just to, like, get in this state and just find my three-card patterns and just, it's very flow. And I love it. I'm usually pretty good. The person that taught me, I don't know if I can't remember if I ever beat them. They were amazing.
Okay.
So my husband and I play that, and I always win. Mm-hmm. But if we play this other game called Quirkle, it seems like it would be a patterning game, but somehow it isn't. He always wins. Always wins, and we can't quite figure out
why that is.
Why he's always winning. Mm-hmm. I haven't cracked the code on that game, and like what is, but it's, those two games to me seemed similar. Like, it's tapping into some kind of thought trait.
Yeah.
And it, if you have this thought trait, you have this advantage to the game. And kind of like Poe, it's picking apart ways of thinking, maybe in ways that we're not usually picking them apart.
Right. So using chess and whist as an example, and I've never played whist, but we've talked about wanting to play whist now that we've learned about this game.
Maybe we'll do some extended cut where we play whist. You can watch.
There will be nothing more fun in the world than watching Sarah and me play whist.
Guaranteed.
But so chess is about what you see in front of you, and yes, being able to see in the future, but again, based on what's in front of you. And there's this sort of like ingenious creativity Dupin has, in addition to his analytical ability, where he is able to see beyond. He's able to see, for example, he's able to sort of mind read, which is something that we had talked about as well. And the mind reading is not sort of some kind of clairvoyance. It's based on the steps one takes on uneven stones, and the smile that comes on one's face as one's thinking about something, and the word one whispers as one's walking. Dupin is noticing these sorts of things, for example, with the unnamed narrator, and he can read his mind.
Yeah, like, to the nth degree. The only thing close, I would think, you know, like, sometimes we go through the house, and my husband will make this little noise, like, I'm down in this chest, and I hear this noise, and I immediately, and he hates it, of me doing this. I'm like, what are you thinking about? Because I know he's thinking a funny story to himself. And it's usually something he saw in a movie, and it's always, like, wild and unrelated to anything going on.
So yeah.
Like, what are you thinking? I know that noise.
That little... being able to, like, so those are patterns and things like that. And the interesting thing, so I might be able to pick up on some patterns like that as well. Maybe, maybe not. What Dupin does that is one step beyond that is he can see something somebody has never done before. They don't make this utterance, this grunt, this groan, this And he's able to sort of extrapolate what that means, which truly seems a gift, right? I mean...
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, I don't know, I would say that it definitely goes to the realm of fiction, but it's close enough that when he explains it, you're like, oh, okay, okay.
Okay, yeah.
On the verge of credible. I see now, like, I'm reading, so I did a big brain dump of thoughts, and then Carolyn neatly organized these into questions, and I'm like, oh, that really just flows into the next one. Good
job. One question was an entire page long.
Shh. She's good, folks. She knows how to edit.
She has a lot of thoughts, folks.
A lot of thoughts that aren't necessarily cohesive when they first come out. But that, you know, give me some grace, please, in this podcast.
Please, both of us, because I'm not always sure if we're talking about Poe or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So, yeah.
Should we do question three?
Yeah, we may have.
Kind of. There's some. So I think we touched on it. Dupont excels at the game of observation.
Mm.
We talked about. He's able to access recesses of thought altogether inaccessible to ordinary men. We talked about. He's able to read his friend's mind as they walk the streets. How do you feel when people try to read your mind?
Mm-hmm.
How often are they right? How often are they wrong?
Tell me, Sarah, because I added those last couple things, but I think that that's pretty interesting for me. Like, tell me, who thinks they understand what's in your head, and how often are they right, and how often are they in left field?
You know, maybe I don't have knowledge of how often they're right,
mm-hmm.
But I would, because most of my experience, I'm like shocked at the wrongness. I'm like, what? What?
So,
do you see that?
Do you have an example?
Like, almost everything. This is hardly even credible because we were talking about earlier my visit to the tile store. We're trying to pick out tile for that. And she doesn't even have to read my mind. I'm saying out loud, I don't like tile that looks like wood.
To be fair, she also doesn't like tile.
Yeah, I don't really care for tile, but I'm pragmatic, and there's some surfaces on where it, you know, it's the best choice for the job.
She has resolved herself to that, but still does not really, at her core, like tile.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
It's cold, and it breaks things.
Mm.
But, you know, so I'm saying I don't like tile that looks like wood, and this woman goes, I do. Let me show you this. Do you like it? I'm like, okay, well, you don't have to read my mind there. That I said out loud, and you're still not hearing me. Right. So,
right.
I have to give some thought to.
I'm feeling like this woman is not going to be one of our four listeners.
I don't think so. And if you are, I apologize. You're out there doing your best. You're doing your best.
I'm sure.
No. I was late, and you started out annoyed with me and my family.
Okay.
Probably.
Okay. So you were late. You know. She expected you a specific time. You were not there at that specific time. However, when you made your interests and your likes and dislikes known, and she's like, cool, let me show you this wood tile. Is she doing her best? I don't secretly know the answer. I'm asking the question.
I've got to assume. I usually think people are. And if their best is annoying to me,
Their best is, here you just are. Said you don't like wood tile. Can I show you my best wood tile?
No. Can we look at something else?
Yes. Yes.
she thought, and that's the thing, you know, people think they're going to convince you and they're like, right. But have you seen? No, still.
Right. I show you how amazing this wood tile is, you're going to completely change your mind on what wood tile the potential of wood tile,
and
you're
going to
be like,
say,
what?
I can't say I'm immune to that human urge. So a lot of people tell me, like, I don't like mayonnaise. And I'll be like, but I make my own, and it's amazing. You've got to try it. And they usually like it.
Okay, I have to say, I've never tasted your mayonnaise. I love mayonnaise, and I can't understand not liking mayonnaise.
You love my mayonnaise.
I actually am pretty sure I will.
Yeah, so good. It's just straight olive oil, egg, the salt, a little mustard. A little mustard, that's right. So a little mustard in
it. It's got a little kick in it. Okay.
It's good stuff. Anyway, tell me your answer.
So,
who's reading your mind correctly or incorrectly?
Very rarely is my mind read correctly. I have, people have described my face as very expressive. It's been described as other things as well.
Lovely.
Yeah. Oh, lovely is at the top of the list, I'm
sure.
Yeah. All of these things. And also very expressive. So I often express what I'm thinking. If I'm feeling lighthearted, if I'm feeling angry, if I'm feeling sad, you can look at my face and you're like, got it. Like, got it. So I think in some cases, people think they know what is going through my head and they don't. So an example will be, I host a lot of parties and gatherings. And
she does.
I do. And, I am not, I am the best hostess from the perspective of what do you need? Can I help you? Can I get that for you?
She is.
But I am not the best hostess from the, hey, I'm part of the party. Hey, cool. Yay. Fun party. I'm like, I would rather be at somebody else's party. So I look, I have like this pained expression, this sort of like,
can I get you a drink?
Gin and, would you like a gin and tonic? Would you like a beer? Would you like wine? Hands. What would you like? What do you need? What do you need? Tell me what you need. So people are like, oh my God. So I've had people come up to me and say like, oh my God, are you okay? You just, you seem really sad. And I'm like, no, I'm not sad. No. Oh my gosh. Well, you see, like they come up with all these things and I'm like, I just need to get you the gin and tonic you asked for on the back patio. So if you just let me get that gin and tonic and let me finish my gin and tonic, it will all be fine. But I'm using that as an example for it. Like a lot of times people think because my face seems like, you know, the facial equivalent of an open book, they're like, got it, understand what this thing is. And then they translate it and extrapolate and suddenly, oh my God, are you going through a rough time? Yes.
This
I have
party.
I have to get you this gin and tonic you requested. And I don't even know where my gin is. Like,
that's funny. I'm similar and different in several ways. First of all, you made me think, like, I've cultivated this whole persona I call Sarah Flatface.
Oh, can I see it?
It's real. And I use it all the time in my, like all the time in my professional life in science. Whenever I'm starting a new job, I always start these jobs and I don't know anything, like this podcast. I start things. And I'm like, I don't know. I walk in. What's your, do you know what? No, I don't know. I have no idea. My skill is figuring it out. That is my skill. And yeah. So I approach every conversation with not knowing anything anyone's saying. And rather than give anything away, Sarah Flatface just asks questions.
So it's poker face.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Is that an orange bike on your glass?
Yeah.
Okay. That's it? Obviously it is.
And now I know from her flat face that she hates the orange bike on my
glass. Don't.
No, but see, we, you know, it's about, like, I'm interpreting, so I'm like, She didn't say it was a really cute orange bike. So she's like, is that an orange bike?
When you need anything, you can't come in acting like your question is insinuating that they're doing something dumb or that you're dumb for not understanding what's happening. You know, so I try and be as neutral as possible.
Or that it's good.
Right. Maybe it's terrible. I don't know.
You just want to know.
I just don't know. I'm walking in blind.
Yeah. So you just want to know, is it an orange bike?
Sometimes I do think it's dumb. I'll be like, what are you saying? But that's not, again, pragmatic. That's not it's not an effective way to get things done. Mm-mm. It's to put people on the defensive. So I squish that down.
Right.
Off from Sarah Flatface.
Sarah Flatface.
She's always there to help me.
I like that it's not a poker face.
No.
Yeah, it's a flat face. Why is it a flat face instead of a poker face?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm just, I don't know enough about poker. Maybe I just like the concept. Have you seen those like flat Matthews?
No.
Oh yeah. So for a while, I don't know if kids are still doing this.
What
they
is
had
it?
These flat Matthews and like some kid would, have a, it's like a paper doll. They would color and send to their uncle in somewhere, and then their uncle would take them around and take pictures with them. I'm like, look, here I am with Flat Matthew. And I was like, his name's Flat Matthew.
What?
His name's Flat Matthew.
What? Yes.
I want a name like that. So, Sarah Flat.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He's flat because he's actually flat. My face just reveals nothing. And I don't know. I don't know. Maybe poker people reveal nothing. Maybe they subtly reveal the opposite of the truth.
I do have a poker face.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Does it reveal nothing or does it reveal the opposite of the
truth? It reveals nothing when I'm working at it. I look at the cards and I'm like, oh my God, it's a straight flush. And I'm like, hmm. All right, well, I'll meet the bet and I'll, you know, go in an extra whatever. Throw in another blue chip or two. I'm like, poker face.
They exist.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have the sense, would you say, Sarah, like, okay, Dupin is your friend now. The main character of The Murders in the Rue Morgue, he's also the main character in The Purloined Letter and The Mystery of Marie Roget. This guy is now your best friend because Sarah is the unnamed narrator, in case you were curious. Like, how do you feel around this guy? He knows what's in your head.
Yeah, he's kind of freaky. After that part in the book where, like, he picks up the conversation that, you know, the narrator wasn't having.
Yeah.
I would probably just ask him to do that all the time. Do you know what I'm thinking right now?
Like, it's a parlor game, right?
Yeah. Yeah. How often is your... Because so I do this other thing, the reverse of what I was saying people do with me.
Hmm.
And that is I do like to put the pieces together. So I do... I'm attracted to this character. You know, you pick all the pieces and then kind of by Occam's razor, you know, whatever the simplest solution is probably correct.
Sure.
Then you put together, like, this is what's happening in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I am very often correct at those. And so I think they're very fun. I'm sometimes wrong, but I'm often right. And so I would probably be quizzing this guy all the time to just be like, how right are you? How often?
Right.
And see if we could, like, I'm not that good.
Right.
He's, like, freaky good, but.
Right. So I think if I'm remembering correctly, one example is, like, in the story, the woman who's on the ground outside the building, the mother, the police determine, okay, well, the guy broke all her bones. And Dupin determines, no, the fall broke her bones. So why can't the police see what Dupin sees? Because they've already decided the one thing. And once they land on it, it's like it's this fixed thing in their brain. And then they springboard off of that fixed thing. Whereas Dupin is able to sort of like let information exist fluidly. He's able to like take all these different pieces and decide what's right, what's real, what makes sense and what doesn't. And move them around and also not necessarily buy into the one thing here, which then limits where you go from there. But he's like, I'm not sure that somebody did break her bones. I think the fall broke her bones. But he's able to ask those hard questions and put every piece of evidence on trial for its life.
Yeah. Which I think, it kind of speaks to coming to the situation without any assumptions. And to be fair, and this is a spoiler, so if you haven't read the book,
there's going to be spoilers. Pause. Spoiler alert.
You haven't spoiler noticed alert. From most of the covers of Murders in the Rue Morgue what happens, you know? Like, the police are going in there assuming that it's a human. A fair assumption.
That a human has committed the murder.
Yeah.
Because most murders are committed, I would guess, by humans.
Yes.
Yeah. I you know, that, you know, dog in the backyard and that deer in the forest didn't commit a murder, for example.
Or maybe they did.
Or maybe they did.
Yeah. So it's not like, I think it's an interesting pause to realize, you know, the assumptions they were starting with weren't stupid assumptions.
Mm.
And I think, you know, if one wanted to apply it back to oneself, like, a lot of times we are blind to what seems like a really basic assumption. And he's just open to, like, whatever. He starts with, like, the nail in the window, you know, trying to solve how all the doors were locked and the windows were closed. And so he starts with, like, the latch in the window. And kind of branches out from there.
Yeah.
And uses pretty much the same principles of like, well, this is the simplest solution. These are the things that have to be true. How do they fit together?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's a funny character. I'm looking forward to the next book.
Yeah.
You said he's in the Purloined Letter too, right?
Yes, he's in three Edgar Allan Poe stories that are considered sort of together the foundation of detective and mystery stories by many people, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Which is cool. I have one of these complete works of Poe books, but I hadn't read it since high school, which is enough time to certainly forget everything. So it's kind of like starting new, hardly reading them before.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes.
So have we covered question four?
Well, number four talks a little bit about the prefect.
Yeah, I think that was one of mine, and I think I put it in there because I hadn't fully wrapped my head around the sentence yet.
Yeah, so the prefect of police, so this story takes place in Paris. Maybe we've forgotten it. Paris, amazing.
I haven't been there yet.
Oh.
I said yet, but...
Maybe on like our 1 year anniversary of the podcast, we should go to Paris where it all begins.
Should. Would you like to join us?
Oh, we can have a big party in Paris. I'm very good at throwing parties. I'm very stressed out. Can I get you a cocktail? Can I get you something to drink?
Oh, that's the other thing you made me think of is like I like to have groups over, but I am a little stressy about it and I'm not the social smoother in this situation, but my husband is.
He is very good. He's very good.
So I'll just kind of send him about on errands.
Nate is like Carolyn, but he's less like this.
Nate won't always know to like, he'll get so involved in the conversation, he won't think to like get the drinks and
oh,
the snacks.
No,
and stuff.
You've got to get the snacks
That's
and drinks.
That's me. I'm like,
that's why you and Nate are good together, right? Yeah. He's schmoozing and you're getting the drinks.
Yeah, he's the smoother.
And I'm having fun because it's not my party. So the prefect, right? The chief of police, the prefect of police. Dupin describes him, his intellect as he's too cunning to be profound and his wisdom is no stamen. It's all head and no body. He has attained his reputation of ingenuity the way he has of denying that which is and explaining that which is not.
Oh, I think you took out the part, too. It called him a codfish.
Yes.
All head. And that was the weirdest all head part. And, all head and shoulders.
Yeah, all like head and codfish. Shoulders. What? Yeah.
And that came up in Bleak House, too.
Yeah.
I remember they talked about someone as a codfish. And the nice thing is, with my copy of Bleak House, I highly recommend, there's an index in the back where you could look up all these, like, weird Victorian idioms.
I need to get that copy from you because I have a copy of Bleak House, which is has 1,000 notations in it, and I can't find it. So here, right, so the stamen produces pollen, right? So it's all about fertility, like creative fertility. So the police officer is the chess player, right? Like he can see what is in front of him, but he can't see beyond what is in front of him.
Yeah. Yeah. When I looked up the codfish idiom in Bleak House, because I was like, there it is again, this codfish saying. I'm not fully satisfied with it. It was just like saying this was like a dead fish.
Okay.
And shoulders like a dead fish and like kind of absurd. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that. I think there's more to that idiom.
Well, the prefect seems upset that Dupin has stepped in at all. And yet the wrong guy is imprisoned for this murder. So, I mean, man, you're pretty jealous when you're like, ooh, you shouldn't have stepped in because I don't look as good when the wrong guy's in prison.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a serious charge, right? You're charged with murder.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just like looking at it. That's what happened too when I finished the book and this thing about the inspector. I'm like, what does he mean exactly?
Mm.
Denying that which is and explaining that which is not. Well, I guess that's pretty clear.
Because it has to fit into his box. So he has this box that he has defined. This is what the crime is. These are the details of that crime. If it doesn't fit into that box, it just goes outside the box, right? Because the box is now the holder of this truth that he himself has created. And because he's so invested in his own truth, he can't step outside of his truth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so interesting. And there's probably not even space on this podcast to comment on, like, the relation to, like, modern behavior and the way that we as humans do that.
But we do, right?
All the time. You already have your framework, and if it doesn't fit in your framework, then it's hard to assimilate.
Yes. If it doesn't fit in to what you believe about the situation or the world, right?
I don't even think it's like a bad character trait. I think it's just a human character trait. It's a thing that we do where if our framework's wrong, it's so much mm-hmm. harder to get it right because we have to kind of go back and break our frame and rebuild it rather than just, you know, putting something in the right place in an already correct framework.
And who does that? Who breaks and then rebuilds their frame?
Well, and it's usually a painful process. I think you have to kind of be in this inspector's position and be faced with some wrongness. And it's not every situation. That is one thing I like about engineering processes, if I may. So there's engineering processes. I work in engineering and business processes. Mm. And in engineering processes, I do feel like it's a little bit easier when you're wrong. You've made the part wrong very often.
Sure.
You don't have the right measurement. It doesn't meet a specification. It doesn't perform. I mean, business processes, it's a lot hazier.
Okay.
You know, because there's a lot of opinion that's like, well, is this more efficient or is that more efficient? Well, it depends on how you do your accounting and what measures are you taking. It really does. And yeah. So I think there's certain ways that we avoid being confronted when our framework's quite incorrect.
But I would argue a lot of frameworks are flawed.
Oh, I would say almost all of them.
Mine, all of yours, them. Yours. Like everybody's, we're building atop of flawed, partially built frameworks.
I don't remember who's... I want to say Einstein, but I feel like he's one of those people that everything gets attributed to, so it's probably not him, but someone said, you know, like, all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Someone said.
Like, you go, and you go to the point where your model works, and then it stops working, and you have to figure out why.
So all models are wrong, but some are useful. Mm-hmm. Yes, being willing to entertain the possibility that what you are thinking is wrong, to go backward before you go forward, I have to say from my perspective, very hard. And I think from most people's perspectives, very hard.
Yeah. It probably leads to a tendency to maybe not state things too strongly. I hate that feeling. Yeah. So sometimes I don't always state things as strongly as I think because I'm like, well, I might have to eat that in 5 minutes. So
because you're evolving, your thought processes are evolving,
right? And maybe I've just been wrong so much, so much.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, well, I'm probably wrong, but this is how I see it.
Yeah.
I like your little bit of trivia here.
It's the first locked room mystery.
Yeah, not only like one of the first mysteries, but first. And I guess I didn't realize when I read that locked room must be some kind of subtype.
It is. So in the mystery genre, right, you know, how they figure out the crime by breaking into the room, which is locked. The door is locked. And there's ostensibly no way into the room. How did somebody come into this room to murder this person and then lock the door on the way out? And so they've got to figure it out. So in this story, right, maybe the murderer got out through the chimney, dragged this poor woman, you know, up the chimney as far as she could go, and then kept going. Well, the chimney starts at a sort of a normal normal width, and then gets so narrow that not a cat could pass through it, right? So it can't be the chimney. The door is locked. This other door is locked.
Yeah, the windows were locked.
Right. Like how, by magic, how did somebody get into this room? And that is part of the puzzle and the fun is figuring that out. Part of this genre is not just throwing that detail in there, but like bringing the reader in. So the reader you know, in theory at least, is being told all the details as they're emerging. It's not always the case, as we know, right? But in theory they are. And so I'm figuring it out along with the detective, like, how did somebody get in this room? Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was good. And I liked how Dupont kind of figured it out and actually went through and tested it. Again, mm-hmm. back to the testing, back to the experimentation. Mm-hmm. I always love those kind of parts.
Mm-hmm.
Number six is, why does the narrator, and you have in quotes here, give himself up to his wild whims with a perfect abandon? Who is this guy? Is he even real?
Yeah.
And I don't exactly remember which part that quote comes from. Tell me what you're thinking there.
Yeah, I think it's at the beginning when they're sort of wandering the streets of Paris together, and it's night.
They became a couple of night owls.
Mm-hmm. They became a couple.
Yeah.
And a couple of night owls.
So that was interesting, and that was one of the first things that kind of struck me, was how this friendship came up, mm-hmm. you know, and they were in this bookstore, and this guy was... It seemed like he was in town on business for some reason. And he would go to this bookstore.
The unnamed narrator.
Yeah, narrator. And he'd find Dupont there. And he just... And I get it, too. He, like, found this friend. And he's probably... I have. You know, you met someone, but kind of casually. But you just have this instant feeling like, we would be friends. We should be friends. Do they feel that we should be friends? Because I feel it. First of all, before I go on, have you ever felt that, or am I just a weird person here?
No, I've felt that.
Okay, all right. That's good. People feel this way.
I don't feel it all that often.
Right. No, not very often.
And in fact, I often feel the opposite when I meet people. Like, I don't get this person. I don't like this person. This person is, you know, whatever.
I'm happy to hear you say that, because just earlier this evening I kind of came to the conclusion that I don't like many people.
So. Yes, that's a whole different podcast. It's called, wait for it, Sarah Doesn't Like People.
Sarah and Carolyn dislike people.
Oh, I like people. You just lumped me right in there.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood what you said. You're saying did. At the beginning you feel like you don't like people.
At the beginning I feel. Oh, okay. So my foundation, my baseline is, you've got to be kidding me, and oh, hell no. And then over time, the person wins me over, and I'm like, oh, okay. So some of the people I've liked best and like to this day best, not all of them, but several people, I didn't like all that much when I first met them.
Oh, that's fair.
So
that's
I'm constantly putting ideas in my head on trial for their lives. Like, is this the real deal? Is it not? You know, I've got all the same flaws everybody else does. I tend, generally speaking, to not fix in time things that might be problematic down the road, whether it's a political view or a view about a person I've just met. I'm like, everything's on trial, and I'm constantly evaluating it and seeing what, you know, things are moving up and down, and I'm like,
I like that. But of course, I'm like dying with curiosity now, because I remember when we first met.
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, that's what I want to know. It's like, was I totally repugnant? You're like, who is this person that Carl just hired?
No.
Tell me.
So I cannot remember when I first met you.
Like, you can't. We went out to lunch together.
We did?
Yes.
Oh,
so I got hired.
Was it fun?
Yes, but so my goal, I got hired at this job, and Carolyn was there as a freelancer, but I was told Carolyn gets along with the owner of this company extremely well, and go learn how she does it. Figure out how she is, like, relates to him.
Who told you this?
The woman that hired me.
Who's the woman? Oh, I see. Okay, so... Oh, so you were hired through this process, and the guidance was go talk to Carolyn.
Yeah, go have lunch with Carolyn. She's a freelance contractor. She's friends with the owner. She, like, gets along with him great. Mm-hmm. You know, emulate what she does. And so I was kind of there to learn.
Okay.
And I wasn't there to be like, do I like or dislike this person? I was kind of Trying to just glean what I was supposed to.
What did you glean? I don't remember. I don't remember going.
Neither one of us worked there. It's not a.
So I was a contractor, and you were being hired as an employee.
Yes.
Okay. What did you learn?
I don't remember.
Oh, so it's memorable. It was heartfelt. It was impactful.
I think I just.
That's what I just heard.
How you interacted with this person.
What I just heard is that correct? Am I in the ballpark?
You don't even remember when we met.
I don't remember. I don't remember going to lunch with you.
I was hoping to get some like dirt on myself. I don't know. Like, Carolyn, did you dislike me when we met?
No.
Okay. Well, you can.
I don't dislike most people when I meet them. I don't dislike most people generally. There are people I dislike, and even those people, I tend to like cut them some slack because I understand things about them or whatever. Like, I don't.
I think that's really nice. I think we would all wish that for.
I don't
cut us a little slack.
There are a few people in this world where I'm like, ooh, that person. But for the most part, I'm like, I don't know. I mean, it might not be a person I'd want to hang out with all the time, but I don't like actively dislike them or whatever. I don't know.
Oh, I guess a little sidetracked from a question.
What was the question?
He meets this guy in a bookstore, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
And he thinks they'll be instant friends. And so eventually after the meeting in this bookstore, he tells him.
Okay.
And he's like, basically, like, I think we'd be really good friends. And the guy, like, invites him to, like, move into his house together.
Yeah, I think we'd be really good friends. You want to move in with me and hang out? We won't leave the house during the day. And at night, we're going to wander just you and me.
So they became these kind of, like...
Yeah, it's going to be amazing.
Odd.
Mm-hmm.
Odd friends. And at first I was like, what? But then I was... So one of the things I like about old books...
Yeah.
...is... I think not a lot has changed in human nature over the years, but I do think a lot has changed in, like, ways humans interact with each other.
Sure.
And friendship probably being one of those ways. And so I wonder, I read these books and I'm like, was this weird for the time? Or was it believable? Would a traveler stay just at somebody's house? You know, because you read and people do go stay at each other's house for, like, 3 weeks, 6 weeks.
Mm.
All summer, you know.
So in a certain class, novels. You could do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a certain class, you just bounce from one place to the next. And what's your job? Your job is I'm going to go stay with my next friend for 6 more weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess I was reading this and a part of me was like, is this real or not real? But then now, like I said, I'm halfway through Bleak House and there's some really interesting friendship aspects there.
Mm.
That are surprising. So I'm like, well, maybe that is a thing. Maybe people would do that, form connections in this way, and then move in and start this friendship. I don't know. But it was funny. Your question was like, is this guy even real?
Is he real? So couple things. So Dupin came from money, we think, right? And maybe has less money now, but he's not broke. He's not living on the street.
But he seems pretty poor because they did make a point of saying the narrator was paying for everything.
Right. He's pretty poor, but he still has lodging and food and clothes and, poor people today should be so poor, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all relative. And then it gets really interesting. So we have this unnamed guy telling the story. What do we know about this guy?
Not much. He likes bookstores. He travels for business.
Mm.
Tell me what you're thinking.
I don't know. I feel like...
Do you feel like he's not actually real? Like he's an imaginary narrator?
Yeah. So Gertrude Stein, right, has a friend, Alice B. Toklas. And Gertrude Stein writes this book. This is in the 20th century. It's many years later. The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas. It's not written by Alice. And it's not about Alice. It's actually written by Gertrude Stein about Gertrude Stein. At some point in reading this story, I have to wonder, is this guy real?
Really? Oh, that's interesting. I didn't I didn't think that.
Like, he doesn't seem to have a personality. All he seems to do is just stand in awe, shock and awe and all of the stuff of Dupin. He records everything Dupin says and he writes it down. And dear reader, he's going to share it with you. At some point, I think the reader has to ask, is this guy a device? Is Dupin writing his own story?
Well, I mean, wouldn't it kind of fall apart, though, the point when he reads the narrator's mind? Because then he really hasn't done anything interesting at all.
Unless he's showing how bright he would be if he had a friend, which he doesn't, right. And he read that friend's mind.
Right, if he made up a friend to read his mind. I guess that's possible.
So what I feel like the narrator does is it gives us a sort of bridge, right? So there's this, what's happening? Oh my gosh, how is this working? Oh my gosh, how did he figure this out? And the narrator gets to walk us through how the narrator or a normal person would figure this out. And if Dupin had written his own story, it might be more like, yep, I saw the room and instantly knew that this, that, and the other was the truth. I, you know, put a notice in the paper, found the sailor, pointed out the actual culprit, moved on. So it allows like drama and storytelling and all of the things that might be harder if we were telling our own story. The next amazing thing that I did was, and another really cool thing that I did, what? So the narrator gives us this device. I'm not saying he's not real. We don't know, but.
He's certainly two-dimensional in the story.
The first three pages of my version, I don't know how many pages of anybody else's version of this 1 hour read. So good for me, 20 minutes of the 1 hour read is this intro from the narrator about analytical abilities and also about creative abilities and sort of ingenuity and being able to marry the two. And I'm like, is this the narrator's thought or is he now like in Dupin's mind? Does the narrator even have an independent thought?
Well, that's interesting, too. So that's kind of a different take on it. Is he real or is Dupin just kind of like telling his story? Mm. Or, you know, kind of the thrall that if the narrator should be considered real, that he's just, you know, enthralled with Dupin and what he does and who he is. And I don't know. People do kind of get obsessed with other people, I hear.
I've heard once or twice.
Sometimes. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
What? Is that come up in the next one? The purloined letter? Is it the same narrator?
Same narrator, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Interesting.
Same unnamed narrator.
Well, maybe learn nothing more or a little more about him.
Yeah. Well, we want to talk also, I think, a little bit about how Auguste Dupin in The Murders in the Rue Morgue is a forerunner to other detectives that we are going to meet this year as we're reading. We're all reading books together. You're reading books with us.
You're reading them.
Sam Spade and Hercule Poirot and Sherlock Holmes, all of these detectives, many others, right, are borrowing from this sort of tradition that Poe is going to establish where there's this guy, he's super quirky and eccentric, he's outside society, he has this friend who has nothing better to do than just follow him around and write down everything he says and does. And so I think that this is important. And then the way the story is told, so this person, the unnamed narrator, is going to tell the story in a way that, in theory, the reader can figure out what's happening on their own. Like, what are your thoughts about these conventions as they're going to apply to pretty, in different ways, to different books we're going to read?
I mean, for me, I'm kind of a blank slate in terms of conventions. I always think it's super interesting when Caroline can tell me that one of these things is that. Like, oh, really? Oh, a trope. Great.
trope.
I don't know. Like, for right now, you know, since I jumped from Orders in the Room or to Bleak House, and then I'll jump back to catch Purloin Letter. Because Mr. Bucket is an actual detective.
In Bleak House, yeah. Mr. Bucket is an actual police detective.
Yeah. Mm. So he's a little bit different there.
And he's not an amateur detective.
I don't know Sam Spade, who that is.
Sam Spade. So we meet him, for example, in The Maltese Falcon.
Okay, I've watched the movie. By the way, there are many fine movies.
Well, that's a good point.
These books.
No, that's a really good point.
Yeah, I really wanted to watch, and I think I can now. I have enough No Rush credits on Amazon, like No Rush Delivery.
Oh.
And you get some video
you
credits.
You still get DVDs in the mail.
I do. Yeah. So, but those take like a month now.
I don't own a DVD player, so.
I resent my computer for not having one, and I resent Best Buy for acting like I was dumb when I requested one. So I bought an external DVD player so that I could still watch.
I have this subscription to BritBox.
Oh, I've heard of that.
I just started it when we started this idea of a podcast a month, 2 months, or what, however long ago. And it has a lot of British-born movies, I believe including Bleak House.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
I can't imagine to make that whole thing to a movie. It'd be interesting.
Well, it's a mini-series.
Oh, perfect.
It's a mini-series. Yeah, Gillian Anderson plays Lady Dedlock. She plays Lady Dedlock.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. That's very cool. She's very good.
And I want to watch some of these. I'm a Bela Lugosi fan, and so there's this Bela Lugosi movie for Murders in the Rue
Morgue.
Yeah. I can watch it now. I have enough points built up. I can rent it for free.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So he's going to sort of – Dupin is setting the sort of scene for how other writers are going to develop their main character.
Is that how Sherlock, because I know Sherlock has Watson. Does Watson write the stories?
Yeah.
Okay, I think I've only ever read one.
Yeah, Watson tells the stories, I believe. And Watson is there really as sort of a means of Sherlock Holmes telling what he thinks to some human being. So Watson's there and Sherlock Holmes says, hey, this is what's going on. And this, and you know, same with Hercule Poirot and Hastings, John Hastings. Oh, I don't know his first name. Hastings, where Hastings is there to, you know, he's this blank slate of like big, you know, wide-eyed curiosity. I have no idea what's going on. And Poirot is constantly telling him what's going on and why.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's sort of like this vessel for communicating information out to all of us who are readers.
So that caught on really quickly then, because we have Poe, and then we have Bleak House, which is not that. And
it
then it
did
seems
not
like...
catch on quickly.
Really?
Yeah, it did not. So
I guess, yeah, Hercule Poirot is pretty far in the future. I don't have a sense of how far in the future Sherlock Holmes is.
Later in the century, and so it's actually considered to have started really slowly. So I think Poe was known in large part as a literary critic in the United States and known as a fiction writer in Europe.
Oh, really?
And known best. And for a long time, people were not writing. You know, you would think like, wow, this is so cool, these stories, the Purloined Letter, the, you know, the Mystery of Marie Roget, these stories are so great, Poe did, that he'd have tons of imitators, and he didn't.
Oh, that's really interesting.
It took a while for it to catch on. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, because I keep thinking, you know, because we just started, and all these are new to me, so I just keep thinking back to Mr. Bucket, and like how, and what's his name, Mr. Turlington? They're all just like flat face, closed mouth.
Yeah.
They just appear, disappear. No one knows what they're thinking or why they're doing what they're doing.
Right.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's cool.
And so then that brings us to how did Dupin solve the crime? And did you, Sarah, like, could you figure out who solved the crime without Dupin walking us through how he solved the crime. Is this solvable by somebody else who's not Dupin?
Oh, absolutely not. Honestly, absolutely not. Because, I mean, part of it that he has to walk you through are the tests that he does.
Yeah.
You know, he tested this window and he found out this thing about this latch.
Yeah.
But then he found out this thing about this latch, and I'm not there testing the latches. So he does really have to relate to me.
Yeah.
That part. And I admit I probably would have had the same human bias that everyone else did, that no, it wasn't an escaped orangutan.
Yeah. Would you have imprisoned what's the guy's name? Is it Dubon?
I don't remember. But no, I don't think either, because there wasn't any evidence for him. There was like no evidence.
Except he had walked with the woman back to her house 2 or 3 days or something before the murder with the 4,000 francs.
Yeah, it just seems.
And so his name, I think, is Bon, either Aubon, Dubon, Lebon, I don't know, B-O-N, which is good. So we're tipped off that he's not the guy, right?
Oh, that's clever. I hadn't picked that up.
But he's in jail, and, I guess the police are like, we gotta punish somebody.
But not the orangutan, which was interesting to me.
Okay.
Like, when things ended, you know, it was like, well, you know, there's an orangutan on the loose. This guy probably wanted to sell him for money, and this other guy is wrongfully imprisoned, and so, you know, they returned the orangutan to the sailor. He sold him for some money.
Yeah.
And all's well that ends well. And I was like, wait, there's two brutally murdered women here.
Yeah.
You didn't put that orangutan down? I would have thought that would have been the next step, but.
Well, so yeah, so it gets to, it's another question we have here on our list, which is at tetonicandtoxin.com. like moral responsibility, right? So the prefect of police, the chief of police, like, what responsibilities does he have as a human being and as a chief of police to put the right guy in prison? And then the sailor, you know, he's sailing around. Where did he get this? Borneo?
Yeah, I don't remember.
He's like a Maltese sailor who got this orangutan with a friend in Borneo.
He's like captured him out of the jungle, too.
Captured him out of the jungle with apparently no plan for, you know, what to do next. In fact, I'm just going to lock him in the closet. I'm going to go hang out at the bar with my friends. Everything will be fine. And so what responsibility does he have for taking this orangutan, putting him on the ship, bringing him to Paris?
Apparently none. It was all well and good.
And when, you know, it's brought up at some point, I think, that we're like, okay, what's going on with this orangutan? Well, he's out of control or what have you. I think he's got the razor, right? He's trying to shave.
He's trying to shave. That's right. Freaks him out.
And then the sailor, the way the language is so interesting. It's something like pulls the whip out, which is what he had used to keep him under control. So basically pulls this orangutan, which is orang-otang, the orangutan. Pulls the orangutan out of Borneo or whatever country, puts it on a ship, has no plan for controlling this wild animal, locks him in a closet so he can drink beers with his buddies, finds out that the guy, he's almost like a guy, right? He's like trying to imitate the sailor by shaving, pulls out the whip that the language suggests he has used in the past. What responsibility does this sailor have for pulling this orangutan out of the jungle, whipping it, locking it in a closet? It gets free, and suddenly it kills two women. And I don't know. I think there's a bigger set of issues here.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, like back in the day, what laws even existed?
Yeah.
I don't know how. I assume things were. I don't have a reason not to. I just assumed that things would have been handled that way if that had happened.
I think so, yeah.
But they weren't probably, it was a very rare case to have an orangutan. So no one had anticipated what would happen if you had a killer animal on the loose.
Right.
And so it's just like, yeah, I felt like things didn't end in a satisfactory way, although it seemed as though it was written that it should have ended in a satisfactory way.
Right. So this guy, Dubon, I don't remember his name.
Yeah.
Something Bon. He's free, and he had done some service or favor to Dupin at some point earlier. And so Dupin feels like, okay, I owe this guy. I want to help this guy. There's no money involved. So we're going to see a different set of criteria in the purloined letter. Where in this story, it's not about somebody paying Dupin for solving this crime. It's Dupin solving the crime. And really, you know, he knows he can solve it, and he also knows the guy and feels like he owes him something. But yeah, it's for me, it's a troubling scenario, because this sailor guy is basically like, I don't know, scot-free, right? Like what?
Yeah, not just scot-free. He gets the money for selling.
Yeah, yeah.
For selling the orangutan. The orangutan goes on with his merry life of imprisonment. And two ladies are dead. What you gonna do?
It happens, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah.
No, it's interesting. I things wouldn't go down that way today. I'm not sure that the way things would go down today is the correct way either.
Sure.
I think there's plenty to be discussed about legal consequences and things like that.
Culpability. But, like, how do you distribute culpability here?
Yeah.
And then, Sarah, you also mentioned earlier in this podcast, but also you and I have discussed, like, the cover of a lot of the stories and or books, give it away.
Yes. I was looking for what copy of this to get, and I would always see, like, this man, like, orangutan on the cover, and I was like, oh, right, it wasn't a human. That's the twist.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Like, got it. Godzilla,
you know,
got
everyone
it.
Reads this for the first time. You don't have to give it away.
Right. So I think that's also part of an evolving convention, right, is, you know, it doesn't have to be given away on the poster or the front cover of the book, right? So we can be taken by surprise by the ending versus told up front.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also wanted to talk a little bit about something that I've studied in my literature background, or my education, where there's this concept of it's called Chekhov's gun.
Yeah, I saw that. I want you to, I can't talk about it.
Well, you can and you will.
After you tell me about it.
So, it's how every element of the story contributes to the whole. So you don't include a random character and then the character just disappears. I mean, unless it's Game of Thrones, in which case that happens more often. it does happen in some literature, but in a lot of literature, if the character's there, they're serving a purpose. They're moving the thread forward. They're helping other characters develop their own characters. They're telling us something we can't get from somebody else. You don't just throw, like, oh, it has to be set in this amazing park, this scene, and then the park has nothing to do with anything. Like, at least in 19th century literature, this is the case, and probably early in 20th century literature, that convention has been muddied in a lot of really interesting ways, late 20th century and 21st century. But for a long time, this was a convention. So the convention of Chekhov's gun, Chekhov wrote, if you say in the first chapter that there is a rifle hanging on the wall, in the second or third chapter, it must go off. So the mystery story, the mystery novel, is interesting because details are thrown in to sort of obfuscate, right? They're thrown in to make it difficult for the unnamed narrator, for Dupin, for the reader, to know what matters and what doesn't. You have to sort through the things. This is not a chess game, it's whist. You have to be able to read the room and understand what's going on. the rifle is held up and displayed and it may not ever go off. And it's a concept often called a red herring. Mm. So we have 4,000 francs in two bags on the floor in an apartment where two women are murdered. And we're like, ooh, 4,000 francs. That sounds like a lot of francs. I have to be honest. Feel free, dear listeners. I have no idea in 1841.
They make it seem like a lot, though. They have a big guy, like, having to carry it in bags.
I feel like it's a lot. And so we're like, okay, was that a motive for the crime? Like, the crime is called outré, which is like gross. It's bloody and it's gross. We can't find a motive for it. We hear these disparate voices. We hear like a gruff French voice and a shrill, we don't know what it is. And all these, you know, like Dutch, Italian, French, like, oh, I think it's a French person. Oh, I think it's an Italian person. They don't know what it is. We see this messy room, but there seems no purpose for the chaos with somebody trying to steal fancy clothes. The money's left behind. Like, what do we make of all of these things? And so it's messier and muddier than stories often were, in a really interesting way where you have to sort through the messiness of the story, like the messiness of a room, and figure out what matters and what doesn't.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Again, my brain goes to, like, comparing it with Bleak House.
Tell me how it compares with Bleak
House.
Well,
I don't know. So I haven't read Bleak House before. Carolyn has, but I'm going through it, you know. And at first I was like, oh, the murder doesn't even take place until page 176. And they just say he dies of opium overdose. So it's like, there's no body till page 176. And then I thought, and like, no, wait, there was another death earlier on page 13. Mm-hmm. And now I just got to, like, the third death, which is on page, like, 276.
This is on her copy of the book.
Yeah. So I'm saying the numbers to kind of give you a sense of how far through before things are happening. And then I'm like, wait, but two other people died to make these other orphans that I've never met them. Is that even related? And so I'm constantly asking myself, Sammy, like, what is related in this humongous novel? What is even related or driving the story? And I even got to the point before I talked to Carolyn, I was like, is this a murder story? Or is this like, is this just a mystery of, like, origin story?
There are mysteries regarding origin and story in Bleak House, for sure. Bleak House is hard to pinpoint as one thing, which is why it's my absolute favorite Dickens novel. It's so good. It's hard to, like, pigeonhole it into one thing. There is a mystery in it, and there is a police detective, Inspector Bucket, and he is considered by a lot of people to be a model of the police inspector in stories going forward. So they're born of this inspector that Dickens creates.
Yeah, but I find myself thinking these thoughts, you know, like, is this relevant to the story? That maybe I don't necessarily always think with just fictional stories.
Yeah.
You know, that don't know that they're driving to a particular place.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in Poe, I hadn't thought about, they do put kind of these, it's almost so short-lived that it's not much of a distraction. Because they're like, well, there's these 4,000 francs and nobody took them. It's kind of like, and all the windows were locked and the doors were locked and nothing makes any sense. We kind of give up.
Kind of. But if we're reading more contemporary mystery novels, we believe that there's a good possibility that the francs mean something. So were there more francs in the room and they left 4,000 behind? Were they so rushed in their departure that they left behind the reason they had come there in the first place? The locked room, how did they get in? How did they get out? So we're trained now to ask all of these questions in reading mystery novels. And in some ways, I think Poe is teaching us to start asking those questions. He didn't know he was doing this, but it starts themes and ways of telling a story that many writers are going to emulate for, 170 years after.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I like all of these kind of trivia tidbits of mm-hmm. things that are going to blossom into things we'll see in later novels.
Yeah, we're going to see how people did this their own way. They made it their own, and how, we can argue, did it better? Maybe did it worse? I don't know. But how they took these ideas that Poe puts on the page and sort of evolve it. And then whatever we're seeing evolve there, we're going to see it continue to evolve.
Awesome. This was a long podcast. I just looked at the time.
Mm.
We should get a clock in here.
We should get a clock. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that we got through our all 10 questions. So I think
we did.
It's an excellent way to wrap it up.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear. If there are any listeners.
All four. No, there's going to be at least four. At least four.
Can they comment on this page on the website?
Hmm. Sure, I can make that happen.
Comment.
I'm
your answers to
tech
the
support.
I don't want to.
Oh, no.
We'll figure out the social media too, because that's always a good form for comment and cross-commenting.
It is. I like that. And we'll be posting this blog live for sharing and then meeting together once a month to discuss.
Yeah.
To discuss more next month. We're discussing The Purloined Letter, also by Edgar Allan Poe, also with the unnamed narrator telling the story of Auguste Dupin.
Awesome. And then after that, Bleak House. So start now. It's a long one.
Bleak House. Yeah. Purloined Letter is a good hour. And I say a good hour, like
put your brains in your head.
Put your brains in your head.
And put your brain hat on.
Brain hat.
On top of it.
Yeah.
Because you need both brains.
And Bleak House is, it's long. We can't pretend otherwise. But boy, I got to tell you,
it's great.
It's so good.
I have a lot of thoughts. We're thinking to break it into two parts.
Yeah, we're going to break it.
Tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, it's big enough to warrant breaking into two parts, so you don't have to, stay up every night reading Bleak House. Though, feel free.
Why wouldn't you? If you could, I would love to, but there's a baby sleeping in my room.
Yes. Sarah has issues that I don't have, and I'm still not staying up all night to read it. But it is... honestly, I've read all Dickens.
You read all of them?
Sure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Thank you. I studied in grad school for 4 years, 19th century British novel.
Yeah. So, give Carolyn your questions there.
Well, about the novel, but about other things. Yeah. You're going to have a lot of thoughts, I think, to share.
Oh, I have no shortage of thoughts.
She has... lots of thoughts. Yes.
Pages and pages to be refined.
Yes. At present, I have 0 notes and Sarah has 4 million pages of notes.
All right. So, Purloined Letter, Bleak House, coming up.
Coming up.
This was our first episode. We hope you enjoyed it. We enjoyed it.
Yeah. And we hope you're subscribing to our podcast, and also check out our website, which is www.teatonicandtoxin.com. That's TEATONICANDTOXIN.com. We also have a Facebook page, Tea Toxin and Tonic, and also an Instagram page.
Yeah, and merchandise coming soon.
And merchandise.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now you want it. I want some little teacups.
Designed by Sarah.
Some little teacups over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Teacups and, I don't know what you're drinking your gin and tonics in, but, yeah. Yeah.
All right.
It's been a pleasure, Sarah. This has been very fun.
Thanks, Carolyn. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
Hope you agree, but if you don't, we have a strictly positive comment policy.
Yeah, if you don't, so we don't want to hear about it.
No, yeah, garbage.
No.
Disagreement is fine.
Disagreement, garbage, yes. Other opinions, good. But, you know, yeah, this has been fun. And
that's what counts. Our fun.
Our fun.
Our fun.
Yes. But your fun also counts.
Hopefully, if it's not your fun.
Your fun also counts.
You don't have to listen.
Okay, so I'm going to just come back around from what Sarah's been sharing and say, you matter. You matter, and I think that's what, is that what you were trying to say, Sarah?
Yeah, let's close with that.
You matter.